Hello? Good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear me yet? Ding, 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 ding. I'm not sure which came first, the idea of having this event on Valentine's Day or because we wanted to create a really intimate atmosphere to actually have this event on Valentine's Day. Thank you so much for squeezing in. We actually had so much interest in this event that we had to really try and pull together the table as well as we could, because everyone else is having their one-on-one lunches next door for lunch and dinner today. Anyway, I digress from the subject at hand, or do I? Because our topic today is Where is the Love? Hong Kong's Search for a New Direction Under the Next Chief Executive. My name is Tara Joseph, by the way. I'm with the Board of Governors here at the FCC and Reuters, and it's my pleasure to introduce Professor Michael DeGaulier of the Hong Kong Baptist University. Now, he's gone off and done a survey in January of two groups, one, the general public, the other, the functional constituency votes for the next chief executive. And he's going to bring that together for us, show us what people are thinking in Hong Kong. And I'm also delighted that we'll have comments today, both from David Webb, who most of you probably know well as the editor of the website, and also Emily Lau, who is the vice chairwoman of the Democratic Party here in Hong Kong. We'll make sure that we get comments in and also leave plenty of time for Q&A to get you out of here on time at 2 o'clock. So without further ado, Michael, please come up.
Technology working at the ends, and one right here. The other two screens are blank, so you'll have to turn around and see if you can get a sight of this. Okay. We've got basically David representing the business sector and big business interests, because there's a lot of issues in this survey that he's going to be concerned with. And Emily does the finance committee as well as is on the Chief Executive Election Committee. So that's why we wanted to have these two speaking to these various things, because as you know, Henry's campaign is quite promising.
Is it?
lots of promises. He's promising quite a lot to a lot of people, and so it's going to be quite interesting to see how this goes, all right? Basically, we have one focus. We're focused on the chief executive election. We're looking at the context and challenges that they face. It's the random sample of the general public, about 600 cases, a random sample of the functional constituency that took us almost 100,000 phone calls. It took a lot of phone calls to find these folks, 246 cases, so there's about 241,000 FC voters, and it was done the first 2 weeks of January. Let's start off with something uncontroversial. And we have been polling on identity and questions of identity back to 1993. And if you look at some of this data, we had a rise in the proportion of people who, when they were asked how they felt on National Day, said that they felt proud or excited, okay, by National Day. You can see that the bar and the line there points out the year 2008, which is the famous Olympic year. There was a rise in feelings of pride, and those have subsided over time back to a pretty much a fixed level that's been the case now for much more than the last 15 years. The FC voters seem to have just a slightly higher level of pride and excitement on National Day. Now, this is not the only way we ask about identity and about patriotism and about nationalism, all right? What's also, I think, interesting in this case is on this question of National Day, we found that middle-income voters seem to have a little bit lower level of pride and excitement on National Day, and the highest-income voters, the folks who make $100,000, which is right here, okay, seem to have a bit more than folks in the middle-income level. Now, whenever we ask about this, just because you are not proud and excited on National Day does not mean that you do not support things like the raising of the flag and having school children sing the national anthem. Now, we released this back in October, which when we asked this question back in the 90s, you had very small support for such activities. But in October 2011, when we asked it, much more support, a majority of support now, for singing the national anthem and raising the national flag. So you cannot say just because people aren't excited about October 1st that they are unpatriotic. Okay? You cannot say that. All right? Another way in which we explore this is by asking about identity. Okay? And the first one is how you would describe yourself, one form. And we've asked this question for a long time as well. As you can see in this chart, it goes all the way back to 1993. And years ago, we discovered that when you ask people born in mainland China how they would identify themselves, those who had lived in Hong Kong more than about 12 years, 12 to 15 years is when you began to see a shift, and we'd get a block, a significant size block of folks born in mainland China who would suddenly begin to describe themselves differently, okay, including describing themselves as a Hong Kong person. We would see this shift. And so, as good social scientists, we theorized and hypothesized that 12, 15 years after the 1997 handover, we should see a shift. And the first time we got this shift, unlike my colleague in the communication School of Communication at Baptist, we did not leap to release. In fact, we didn't release it at all. We waited for a second survey, okay? And that's why you have three data points up here. In the second survey, we finally started talking about it. And in this survey, we had people answering other and giving us this new term, Chinese Hong Konger, this new term. In the third survey now, we include it on the list we read, and you can see there's very little difference. It's about a 3-point jump, which statistically is insignificant, all right? So about 1 out of 4 people suddenly, over the last year, began to tell us, no, I'm not Chinese, I'm not Hong Kong Chinese, I'm not Hong Kong British, I'm not Hong Kong person, I'm not overseas Chinese, I'm a Chinese Hong Konger. So what does that mean? All right? And you can see what happened here, and in some ways, looking at the block, you could say, well, this looks like Hong Kong Chinese has shifted. And in some ways it has, but in other ways it hasn't. There's something else going on here. We're still not totally sure what's going on, but we are exploring it with great vigor, all right? And we've got a follow-up question I'll show you in just a moment, all right? But one of the things that's interesting about this, when you ask the question about patriotism, all right, and you tie it to the functioning and identity, and you tie it to this question of about are you satisfied or dissatisfied with the Chinese government and ruling China, all right, you can see the two categories that say either Hong Kong Chinese or Chinese Hong Konger are very similar. Also, the folks who say I'm Chinese have almost 1 out of 3 who are dissatisfied. All right. So just because you say you are Chinese in identity doesn't mean that you're satisfied with the Chinese government's performance. Okay? You can't define patriotism that way, despite what the Wen Wei Bao says. And whenever you start looking at this sense of pride and excitement, these are people who said they were proud and excited, and you break it down by their identities, the 1 out of 5 who say they're proud and excited on National Day show different proportionalities of identity. There's no one dominating identity. Okay? So you can't say, well, if you say you're Chinese, that means you're a patriot. Or if you say you're a patriot, that means you're going to identify yourself as Chinese. You cannot say that. All right? You cannot say that. All right, here's the follow-up question. After we asked them, how would you identify yourself? What's the most appropriate description? We asked then, which do you consider most important to you personally to see protected and promoted? And we're calling this place identity, the identity of the place. And the options were things like China's historical and cultural identity, Hong Kong's identity is pluralistic and international, China's identity is ruled by the Chinese Communist Party. Okay, so this is place identity. How do you identify this place? And as you can see, among both the FC voters, who are the elite in Hong Kong, and the general public, almost no one says the most important thing to me personally to see protected and promoted is China's identity as ruled by the CCP. They cite the historical, cultural, or they cite pluralistic and international. All right, and we've tortured this responses to death in the release that you're going to be getting. I'm just that's available to you. These are just a few selected things. All right, and what you see here in this case, people who say they're proud and excited. Again, this is supposedly the most patriotic group. When you ask them about place identity, this is personal identity, proud and excited. Place identity shows an equal division between those who say China's historical and cultural identity is important to be seen protected, or Hong Kong's identity is pluralistic and international is important to see protected. So just because you call yourself Chinese does not mean you reject Hong Kong's identity as pluralistic and international. Okay? So all the muttering about foreign influence is again the Wen Wei Bao editors talking to themselves. Do we have a Wen Wei Bao editor here? All right. Yeah, I think we have a. I know that.
That's good enough.
I'm quite aware of this. Okay. All right. So then you turn it the other way around and you ask it in terms of their identity and see which is most important to them, and you find, well, this is just, again, there's no correlation in that same way. There are movements, but not substantive and no exclusive viewpoint here. All right. So, satisfaction, the next one. This is the governance context. All right. And in this case, whenever we ask about satisfaction with the performance of the PRC government dealing with Hong Kong affairs, we've seen a bounce from October up, and the FC is a little slightly higher, functional constituency voters are slightly higher. All right. So we're off the lows under Donald Zhang in October, up slightly. When we ask about the SAR government dealing with the PRC government, the other way around, we find that the public says more satisfied than dissatisfied, but it's close. FC voters actually more dissatisfied than satisfied. So if the FC voters are actually represented in the Chief Executive Election Committee, and remember, they vote, they elect more than two-thirds of the members of the Chief Executive Election Committee. So this is the elite electing an elite, okay? And this shows you the overall satisfaction with the performance of the PRC government in ruling China. And you can see that we have recently had, for the first time in a very long time, had more dissatisfaction than satisfaction show up. That's also the case with the FC voters. All right? So I think this also puts some constraints on what the central government is willing to risk. The local government, according to the public, is doing better. Dissatisfaction has gone down. Satisfaction has gone up among the general public. However, it has not with FC voters. They are 60% dissatisfied, just like they were back in the April 2011. This is FC voters.
Yes, sir. What year is the left-hand side?
Which one? This one? It starts in 1993. Runs all the way up to January this year. Now we've been doing this a long time. Right, politics, the political context. This is about the political parties, which party people feels represents them best. We hit a real low in October of people telling us they could name a party. Okay, we dropped well under a majority of people naming a party. The Democrats fighting with each other, the pro-democracy group fighting with each other, had a serious impact on people's willingness to identify a party. But we've seen some bounce off of that, some recovery in that. The FTU has done particularly well, the Federation of Trade Unions. But among FC voters, it's even higher in terms of this identity. Parties are important because they marshal a lot of the votes, hundreds of votes, on the Chief Executive Election Committee. And in this case, what we've done is we've tried to recode these groups so that you can make more sense out of them. The pro-establishment parties now are classified as the DAB, the FTU, the Liberal Party, and the New People's Party. Okay, Rita Fans. Virginia's. The Democratic Pro-Democracy Group is the Democratic Party and the Civic Party. And the pro-labor group is the LSD, the League of Social Democrats, the People's Power, and the CTU, union group together. And then, of course, we have the Arizona system in which you can vote for none of the above. And it's a large block. Now, what's really interesting about the FC and the general public thing, this is by birth compared, and you can see with GC voters, the proportion of people born on the mainland is larger than among the general population. This is an interesting effect that had in the D.C. election. They have organized those folks born on the mainland and are getting them to turn out. They used to have a lower turnout, a lower registration rate. They now have a higher turnout and a higher registration rate. That's one of the reasons why the district council races, they won seats like they did. What's interesting with the FCs, actually people born on the mainland are less. Okay, and people born elsewhere are significantly larger. So the functional committees that Beijing insists we keep are biased against mainlanders, and they're full of foreign subversives. I mean foreigners. Okay, you might want to ask your Beijing friends why they're so committed to the functional constituencies. All right, and this shows you the breakdown of the sample very quickly. You'll notice I think there's 14 or 15 business seats. They have 14 votes. Teachers have one. Except in proportionality, this is not just our sample. This is very close to the actual franchise. Okay, our FC vote, only 246 cases, but thousands of phone calls, came pretty close to a proportional sample in reality. So they have 14 votes to one vote, but they have much fewer voters than even one seat held by educators. All right, so this counts when we talk about unfairness in just a moment. The FC also has much larger civil servant and privatized public sector than among the public. All right, much larger, and a bigger nonprofit sector. Okay, so when the FC votes and the Chief Executive Election Committee votes kind of strangely, it's also, again, the elite is not representative of the people in Hong Kong. And this is by education. People in the FC voters are vastly more educated than the regular folks in Hong Kong. Vastly more. And they're richer. More of them are richer. That's the blue parts. The blue parts, middle and upper class income. And the outer ring is the FC. Right? And the inner ring is the general public. All right. And they're also more active. Okay, in various kinds of groups, as you can see here, across the board. FC is red. Functional constituency is red. All right, so we break it down and compare. Voting for the chief executive by which party represents them best. And what was interesting was in today's news, the DAB says we're not going to choose a candidate. We're not going to enforce party discipline on a particular candidate. And if you look at the FC voters, pro-establishment, okay, they are almost precisely divided. This is the DAB, remember, includes the DAB. They are almost precisely divided between Tang and Lin. So today, this is why today's news happened. Okay, they are divided. They are honestly divided. It's not that they're waiting on the signal necessarily from Beijing. It's that they are really divided. Okay, about who they should support. And you can see among the public who say they're pro-establishment parties, there's a bit more for CY Leung than for Henry Tang. So it's a very interesting case that they're in. Now, if there's no pro-democracy candidate, that allows us to drop it out. And whenever we do that, we get a very different result. We begin to get more people leaning towards Tang in the FC voters, but not in the general public. Okay? And remember, the Chief Executive Election Committee is a sample of the functional constituencies. They're older, they're richer, okay, and they tend to be a bit more even pro-establishment than these folks. All right, issues very quickly here. Most urgent issue, we reclassified some of these. This is by itself. Affordable housing is by 28% of the people, open-ended, and the wealth gap by, I think, 18% of the people. These together are very large issues, of great concern to both the general public and the FCs, both. Okay, and this shows you how we reclassified them. Okay, unemployment, social welfare, cross-border crime, et cetera, socioeconomic stress, systemic reform is healthcare reform, educational reform, constitutional reform, and then the wealth gap is left alone. All right. And what's really interesting here is a key sector. This is among the general public, the age under 30, who are concerned with the wealth gap. This is in the FC voters over 60, and most of the chief executive election committee people are older, 50s and 60s. Look at the difference of concern about the wealth gap. Okay? So if the chief executive election committee votes one way and the people who definitely feel the other get concerned, get upset, get angry about this, we will see very interesting repercussions in Hong Kong. And in terms of the concerns they have, by which candidates they support, again, you can see a variety of divisions between the general public and the FC voters. There tends to be, among the three issues here, the wealth gap, systemic reform, socioeconomic stress among the public, more support for Leung than for Tang. Among the FC voters, it's much closer. There's a little bit more for Tang than for Leung.
Right.
Okay. Systemic issues, very quickly. Fairness. Most people think policymaking in Hong Kong is unfair. Among FC voters, it's even more. Those people who are concerned about various issues in terms of their perceptions of unfairness, people who are concerned about the wealth gap, are overwhelmingly, and economic growth, overwhelmingly thinking that the policymaking is unfair. About who they vote for, folks who say they would vote for Henry Tang, many more of them say policymaking is fair. It's just about equally divided. CY Leung, more people say it's unfair than fair. Okay. Trust, we had a meeting about this morning. What's really interesting about this one, Henry Tang is trusted to handle the big tycoons because he is one. Okay. The public in general is CY Leung. People like yourself more for Leung than for Henry Tang. I guess people don't have wine cellars in their garage. Okay. Best job, competence. Tang handling big business influence, which I think is ironic. In terms of protecting against corruption, making policies fair to everyone, there's a lean towards CY Leung. Right. Open-ended problems. You can see, for example, a rise here from affordable housing, only 4% to 28% now. The wealth gap has been a continuous concern of a significant proportion. We then break this up by these concerns, and you can see whenever we ask how satisfied are you with the government's performance on that problem, we now are at a higher level of dissatisfaction than any we've seen before since 2003. Okay, so some of my pro-democracy friends say, vote for Henry Tang, we'll have another Dong Chi-Wah, and we'll have 500,000 people out in the streets again. Improving government performance, you can see again among the general public, it's much more for Leung than for Tang. Among the FC voters, it's a little more closer in terms of the proportions. So the FC voters, again, are not totally representative, and this is the issue that dare not speak its name. Some of you can remember some of the references that is to. All right. The last couple slides. Change the CE nominating process. The primary experiment worked. People liked the primary experiment that we did here in Hong Kong, a combination of voting and opinion polling. And they want a primary system like that. They support that. in terms of eliminating the FCs by reforming them and making the vote more equal. You can see that it's almost 7 out of 10 who support that. And finally, in terms of abolishing the functional constituencies, oddly enough, we do have a majority, but it's bare among both groups. There's a significant proportion who oppose that. And I think that this is the thing we'll be watching most closely in coming surveys, because our supposition is that actually when people have a second vote, there will be more support for keeping the functional constituencies until those five are outvoted by the 14 or 15 business people, and then there will be a dramatic reversal of public opinion against the functional constituencies as a system. Okay, as soon as they find out their five, elected by over 3 million people, are outvoted by 14 business people or 15 business people with a total of, what, 10, 15,000 voters? And some of whom haven't voted in forever.
To digest there. So why don't we bring Emily up, first of all, to give some response to all that she's taken in the last few minutes, and then we'll move on from there.
Thank you very much, Tara, and a very good afternoon. Happy Valentine's Day. But after seeing this, I don't think you have much stomach for anything, except, of course, for democracy, which we're not going to have. Michael said Henry's campaign is promising. I think that's a big joke. Just walking up the hill here, I bump into one of Henry's supporter, who of course will not be named, and I said, well, you better tell him to withdraw. I said, he's damaged goods. And so is CY Leung, because we're having a meeting in LegCo. We are going to call for all the papers relating to the competition, the design competition 10 years ago. So I think Hong Kong is being turned very, very quickly, rapidly, into a huge international laughing stock. And some business people have asked me, they say, haven't you really got nobody else in Hong Kong? I say, we've got lots of people, but they're not on Beijing's list. And then when Michael said that there's competition and the voters are divided, some vote for opt for Leung and some opt for Tang. Yes, I think that's true because you ask them, you call them up. But what, to me, what is very disturbing is that we are being caught in the power struggle that's going on in Beijing. Under colonial rule, we were sort of shielded from the tumultuous developments there. And they, of course, they always have power struggle. But in the transition that's coming up, the power struggle, of course, is very, very intense. And then you so happen to have this laughable election in Hong Kong. So the different factions in Beijing will latch onto them as their pawns. So only those that the powers that be allow to go forward will take part in this farcical election competition. Those who are not allowed have been sent home, like the two women, Rita and Regina. So my dear friends, what Michael have told us is very disturbing in terms of the identity thing. I would suggest, well, you know Robert Chung. Robert is not as lucky as Michael. Robert also did these surveys about identity, and he has been vilified by the Beijing authorities, calling him a spy and all these things. And I said, well, Michael's been doing a survey, Lau Siu Gai, the head of the policy, Central Policy Unit, has been doing it. Why pick on Michael? And why pick on Robert? So this is a very sensitive subject. If your findings is that everybody is patriotic, then oh, great, Michael, do more. If you find that people are saying, no, they want to be Hong Kong, they don't want to be Chinese, then they come out and say, you are a running dog of foreigners. And the other thing that they are so angry with Robert is that he is planning this internet voting, which I hope all of you will take part, on the 23rd of March, 2 days before this small circle farcical election. Of course, if many people take part, and a member of the Executive Council has wager bet, not Anna, saying, yes, I bet with you, Emily. He said at least 100,000 people are going to vote. So if that's the case, he'll win. If less than that, I'll lose. Only one meal. But I think many people are very excited. You'll have to go to Robert's website to find out. But that's what Beijing doesn't want. All this polling, all this finding out what the people want. That's the last thing they want to know. And I suggest to Michael next time, if you can add another category, because many people say, oh, those people are pro-China. I say, wait a minute. We are all pro-China. So what are they? They are pro-communists. If you add that category, Michael, maybe you can tell us whether you've tried. You may get some very interesting responses. Well, the thing is, that's what the people feel. That's how they feel. They want to protect Hong Kong's core values. They don't want to have a revolution, but they want to have the rule of law. They want to have freedoms. They don't want corruption. They don't want conflict of interest. These are the things that we want preserved. And we are Hong Kong, and we understand we are part of mainland China. Although I have been banned from traveling to mainland China for 20 years, and many members of my party have been banned. In LegCo, there are 60 of us in the council. 11 have been banned for more than 20 years, my dear friends. Maybe some of you don't even know it. Why? Because the media are too shy to tell you. Because this information is embarrassing to Beijing. So the information here, I don't know whether Beijing will find it embarrassing or not, but they are the findings of somebody who is independent and objective. And I hope long will Michael be allowed to do these surveys, and so is Robert. But whether they can or not depends on all of you in this room and outside, whether we will speak out when we see these values being eroded. And please take part in the vote on the 23rd of March. I don't know who you're going to vote for, because I think those two candidates should withdraw. I don't think they have much integrity, and I don't think they should run Hong Kong. Then who else will do it? Well, I'm sure we can come up with somebody else. After all, we've got 2 weeks for the nominations. And if you have good friends whom you think should lead Hong Kong, please encourage them to come out and give Hong Kong people a better choice. Thank you very much.
David.
Big business. Big business.
Well, yeah, I am quite somewhat amused to be the representative of big business. But I'll have a go. Well, Michael, I mean, first of all, I mean, kudos to you for trying even to sample and find members of the 1200 election committee, the elite, as you call it, including yourself, of course, as in the higher education sector. Not surprising, then, that so many of the members of VFCs that you did reach, the 246 that you could reach, have high educational attainment. The teachers, by number, in terms of people who have an FC vote, account for about 40% of the 240,000 people who have a vote. But there's the thing, that although there are vast numbers of highly educated people in there, it's only a very small number of the FCs that really matter because of the way the FCs are weighted. So in LegCo right now, we have 30 functional constituencies, and of those, 9 have very broad-based electorates, and they actually tend to have tended in the past, particularly when pro-democracy was more popular, to elect pro-democracy legislators like Margaret Ng and Fernando Chung and Sin Chung Kai in the IT sector, for example. So those 9 do have a tendency to be quite democratic, and that's what happens if you broaden out the constituencies. The other 21, though, only have 8% of the FC electorate, but 21 seats in LegCo, and they're the ones that the government depends on to get things done. And if you try and reach out and sample, you're going to find in that sample of 246, only a handful of them, or a little bit more than a handful, 8% of them probably on average, will be in those narrow constituencies. Some of those didn't even have to vote because they returned their EC members uncontested. Quick plug, if you go to website.com, there's a Who's Who database, and key in HKSAR Election Committee in the top organisation search, and you'll get all of the members of the Election Committee, past and present. There aren't actually 1,200, because one of the subsectors screwed up in their rigged uncontested attempt, and one of the candidates was not correctly nominated, and so they were one short when the returns came out. So you start with 1,199, and then, in fact, you reduce it by another few, because some of them are both LegCo members and NPC delegates, and I think they can only vote once, even though they qualified twice. So when you get to the final tally, there's only going to be about 1,195 minus people who are on holiday or too ill to vote, or too senile to vote. The corporate voting thing, the basic law speaks to gradual and orderly change in the election system. And we've had some gradual and orderly change, very sort of glacial change, I would call it, in things like the super voting, the district council seats that we're going to have next time round, where the entire population gets to vote for five candidates picked by the DCs. Unfortunately, though, although we're including DCs more so, district council members more so in this new election committee for 2012, they were elected by block vote. And there's no form of proportional representation in that election. So nearly all the 100-odd new members are pro-Beijing, pro-government types, because, especially when you include the appointed members of the district councils, the vast majority of the district councils are pro-government, pro-Beijing, and so they have returned an extra body of voters, which tilts the election committee more in favour of the government and Beijing than before. So in fact, that broadening didn't really have any effect in terms of making the EC more representative of the community. It's not at all surprising that FC members have higher incomes and higher education levels. A lot of the FCs, by definition, require you to have an education level, qualified as an engineer, an architect, a surveyor, or a planner, qualified to teach at a university or in a school. A lot of these FCs, by their nature, require a higher educational attainment, and therefore, not surprisingly, also higher incomes on average. And also, of course, within those FCs, they tend to elect more established members of their community, more senior architects, more senior lawyers and engineers and so on. They tend to be older on average than the community, and again, less representative of the community. The FC system also allows people you might not expect to be able to vote, Taiwanese banks, for example, in the finance sector, mainland banks in the finance sector. More mainland banks than ever before have offices here now, and they are qualified to appoint employees to vote in the FC elections. And one thing I took away from looking at the 1,200 members as I went through the results in December and put them into the database was that there is a shift towards mainland names, simply in the list, more mainland Chinese surnames than before. So there is increasing influence, and if that's going to be the nomination system in 2017, it does point to some of the problems we're going to have. In terms of the overall opinions, I think you have to treat them with some element of caution. I'm sorry, Michael, it's not your fault. But since you could only reach 246 FC members, the sample error on that is going to be plus or minus 6.4% roughly. You take the square root of that number and divide it by the number of respondents. So, you've got a 12% range of uncertainty with a 95% confidence level on these figures. And when you try and subdivide them even more amongst the FCs, then your uncertainty level goes up even further. and the vast majority of the people who did respond would have been in those top five or top nine. The top five, by the way, account for 80% of FC voters. The top nine account for 92%. So their responses, I wouldn't expect to be greatly different after you adjust for income and education levels, not greatly different from the community at large, because they really are the community at large. They're the people who elected Margaret Ng. There are people who elected Maddie Tam as the accounting legislator last time round, and so on. Also, I think some of the sentiments about government performance are correlated quite strongly with the economy and the Hang Seng Index. It's not a coincidence that 2003 was the year that Tung Chee Hwa was deposed. It probably would have happened sooner or later in a 10-year time span, but that was when the economy was most depressed and people were venting a lot of frustrations. And then when you look at the profile of people who are satisfied with the government, and it's not surprising then also that they're correlated with Henry Tang, because he has a closer association with government policy, having been an official member of the EXCO rather than a non-official member, whereas C.Y. Leung has almost no association with anything. I mean, if you look back, he served on the Honours Committee and the committee that hands out the JP appointments. All of the government committees are in my database. You can look at where people have served. Henry, on the other hand, has been appointed through his position to various committees, such as the Poverty Committee and so on, that are associated with policy. So people who are happy with the government are likely to support a quasi-incumbent candidate. On the other hand, people who are less happy would probably prefer someone new, whoever it is. Personally, if I had to choose, and I don't have a vote in this, firstly, I'm not employed, but if I was, I'd probably be in the financial services sector. The financial services sector, there is a seat in LegCo called financial services. It's occupied by a convicted criminal. He went to jail for faking signatures on share transfers. And he's elected by stockbroking companies and members of the Gold and Silver Exchange and futures broking companies. But if you work for one of those companies, if you're one of the 32,000 people licensed by the SFC to be trustworthy enough to handle other people's money, you're not trustworthy enough to have a vote. You don't get to vote in financial services.
David, I'm going to ask you to wrap up just because we're out of time and I want to make sure we get at least one question in.
Sure. So I'll just say, it's a horrible choice to make between the two leading candidates. On the one hand, you've got simple but capitalist Henry. On the other hand, you've got sophisticated but more socialist C.Y. Leung. The choice to me is who will do the least damage to Hong Kong rather than who will do the best things for Hong Kong. On that basis, I'm afraid I have to go with the capitalist, but I prefer not to have to make that choice at all.
Thanks very much. So we have time for two questions. Please raise your hand. Hopefully there's a mic around and let us know your name and where you're from. Maybe with the lack of microphone, you can just stand up and...
In your survey, it shows that C.Y. Leung is way ahead of Henry Tang. You talk about popularity rate. Do you think that really matters when you talk about who's really going to become the next chief executive? And also, how would you think that the recent scandals surrounding the two candidates will affect the election? Thank you.
I think the main thing that we're trying to show is that the difference between the public and the FC voters in terms of their preferences for chief executive candidates are substantial. And if the CEC, the election committee itself, which is, as David described, and I agree with him completely, is that they are not representative even of the FC voters in many ways. They're older, they're richer. As he was saying, they're more mainland names that he's noticed on the committee itself. When Beijing this time said that they were going to take public opinion seriously, the interesting thing is that Hong Kong people have tended to believe that. I think that's why we're having these reactions to these so-called scandals in which allegedly the Hong Kong government has indicated its favor of one candidate or another, and you've seen this very ferocious reaction in both the media and the public to this perception of unfairness or favoritism. I think that's because the Hong Kong public actually has believed the central government saying that it's not going to intervene. Everybody's been looking for the handshake, the bigger smile, the whatever it is, the signal, you know, to, that one of these candidates is favored over the other. And it looks like the public is policing this and trying to prevent it. And I think that it's effective enough that the DAB, who is not known for courage, okay, has decided not to be courageous. Okay, that indicates there's something real there. Okay, I don't think it's just that they haven't got the signal yet. I think they actually feel the heat of public opinion in this case. And that's what we're trying to show. I think there's a real danger that the election committee will not reflect that public opinion. I think that they probably already favor one candidate over another. But I think that they would be well served to pay close attention to what the public is saying, just like Beijing said they were going to do.
Time for one more question. Going once? Done. Sold to the lady at the end of the table.
Anna Lewis from the University of Oxford. I was just wondering, did you ask people when you asked them about their identity how strongly they felt for any of them?
No.
Any reason why not?
Because we don't do it that way.
Okay, fine. Just if you had a...
Robert does that.
Oh.
And Robert also, for technical reasons, his categories are kind of wonky as a social scientist. All right?
Okay.
We use historic categories. Overseas Chinese, that's historic. Hong Kong British actually is attached to the BNO passport. A Hong Kong person developed in the 1950s, 60s, 70s. These are commonly used terms. I don't know what a Hong Kong citizen is. This is what Robert uses. I really don't know what that category is. It doesn't have a legal basis, doesn't have a historical basis. It's kind of a weird thing. And then when he asks people how strongly they identify with one category or another, I think there are flaws in that. That's why we had our follow-up question in which we ask about place identity. Okay? So there are technical arguments you could have back and forth, but I agree with Emily that this is not a case in which the national government should be jumping up and down on the top of an academic researcher. I mean, for heaven's sake, we're just asking questions and reporting answers. Okay? And we have our arguments among ourselves. And certainly I'm more than happy to have a discussion with the folks from Wen Weibao who wrote very negative articles about me in the past, which is fine, all right? But if you're doing research on identity, I think we showed very clearly that there's a whole lot more questions and gray in the responses than what appears in Wen Weibao.
Thank you. We'll leave it on that note. Michael, thanks very much for sharing your survey with us today. And David, Emily, thanks very much for your views. Have a wonderful afternoon. And if people have questions for Michael, he'll be here for a while. Thanks.